Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 27th of August. Very nice to have you with us on this rather sultry Monday, muggy Monday. Just another muggy Monday. And it's nice to have you with us. We have a great panel. Let me introduce them to you. And we will get started for this morning. Political consultant Libby Post is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. You teaching this semester?
No, next semester.
Oh, okay. Classes start today.
Yeah, they do.
Scary.
Yay.
No,
it's amazing.
Summer's over.
That's the part of it that's weird.
Let's see. Who else do we have? Joe Bonilla is with us. He is a communications consultant. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Very nice to have you here. Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson is with us. She directs the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning.
Good morning. Law school classes started last week.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. Aren't you guys tough?
Lawyers always get the early,
that's
early
right.
bird gets the worm and all of that. That's good.
Like that.
Do you prepare?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Weeks in advance.
Yeah. Good morning. Nice to have you here. And Alan Chartok is with us as well. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. My fingers hurt. I've been practicing for the Berkshire Ramblers annual reunion in which everybody, all the WAMCers come, and everybody comes at the Guthrie Center, 7 o'clock on Sunday. And it's going to be terrific. The problem is it always ends up that there aren't enough tickets. And then people are calling me up and saying, oh, how do I get in? Can you get me in? No, do it now. Call the Guthrie Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And all you have to do is remember 413-528-1955. Isn't that a great year, 1955? Yeah, I remember it well. And
so it's Sunday at 7 o'clock.
Yes, Joe, you're always so wonderful and helpful. But I don't want people to feel that, you know, they hate me because they can't get in at the last minute. So do it now for the Great Berkshire Rambler group.
Excellent. And we'll be talking about that as the week plods on.
You can bet we will.
Yes. We won't let you
over and over.
We won't let you forget.
we
will not let you forget. Let me see. So let's start with what is happening in the world today, and a lot. And it was a sad weekend because we lost Senator John McCain. We certainly found out Friday that they were going to stop treatment of his cancer. The brain cancer that he had, the very aggressive form, non-operable. And then Saturday night we got word that John McCain, a war hero, a senator, a presidential contender, died at the age of 81. He climbed from the depths of despair as a prisoner of war in Vietnam to pinnacles of power as a Republican congressman and senator from Arizona, a two-time contender for the presidency. And according to a statement from his office, he died at 4:28 local time. He had suffered from a malignant brain tumor for which he had been treated periodically with radiation and chemotherapy since its discovery in 2017. There is just the sadness of talking about this one of the greats of the Senate who has passed. And then there's also the political angle, of course, which is twofold. One, the relationship with the President of the United States and the fact that the President will not be going to the funeral, the fact that the President refused to put out an official White House statement on the passing of the veteran senator, and also the other part about now filling his seat and what happens in the state of Arizona. So I throw all of those topics to you.
Well, it's interesting stuff, isn't it? The president, of course, is being roundly thrashed for his attitude towards McCain, who he said wasn't really a war hero because he had been captured. It was unbelievable. It was one of the worst things he ever said. And yet, you know, what's so interesting is you see the poll numbers on the Republicans and they don't budge, on this guy. They don't budge. That's number one. But the independents, and people like me, I'm a registered independent, believe it or not, and I I'm a non-enrolled voter. That's what we call it in Massachusetts, and I can take a ballot in either primary. But I have to say, it really affected me. This death really affected me because he's a decent guy.
He is.
And they've been showing
guy.
Clips of him, telling that woman who said he was an Arab and walking away sort of in disgust and saying, no, he was a good man. We just disagreed on policy. That's one that really stays with you. Decent guy.
Yeah. This whole episode, and yes, the polls are staying the way they're polling, and that's because these people will believe anything out of Trump's mouth because it's all about making America white again, as we all well know. But John McCain, we can all agree to disagree on issues, but that doesn't mean we have to be disrespectful of one another. And McCain was somebody who understood the notion of respect, understood what it meant to sacrifice for one's country, and what it meant to bring divergent people together. Yeah, he was partisan, but he also was able to reach across the aisle, and he showed that, and he did that. What this has done is showed what a little man Donald Trump really is, because it's all about him all the time. And he has just shown how narcissistic he is and how disrespectful he really is of what America means.
Well, I think we need to also separate McCain, the war hero and statesman, from obviously McCain, the politician. I think the one thing to McCain's unfortunate detriment that will be part of his legacy is introducing America to Sarah Palin. And that somewhat led to the rise of the party of Trump in that way.
But it also gave us Barack Obama.
That's very also true as well. That's also true.
You know.
Well, it's sort of emblematic, too, of the death of a certain brand of republicanism, which is what I think we're also grieving in a way, because that was a more reasonable pre-Tea Party, legitimate disagreements. And I think we can hold him up as a war hero and continue to disagree and criticize. I mean, I think there were some people who saw that the moment during the campaign where he said, no, Obama's not an Arab. He's a good man, to say, that there was some underlying, negativity even in that shining moment. But McCain's always been somebody that I admired in the Senate in terms of how he worked his politics.
And, it's interesting because Chuck Schumer, of all people, now, I've always liked Chuck. I know him. I've always liked him. But I think in recent times he hasn't been a good leader. He has not been strong enough in standing up, which is the sort of interesting thing about what you're saying, Sarah. Because at the one hand, you want him to take a guy like a bully, like Trump on, and you really wanted him to give him hell. But he did talk about renaming the Russell Building in the Senate, Richard Russell Building, to McCain's honor. And it's interesting from a lot of perspectives. I mean, Russell, of course, was good old boy, good old Southern boy, and his history on civil rights legislation was nothing more than disgraceful. So it's a brilliant move if you think about it. It offers the Democrats a way out from having one of theirs names on a major building, and it is a major building in Washington, and at the same time reaching across the aisle and saying something good about the other guy.
And paying homage to a man who deserves to be recognized as a national icon. I mean, he really...
Well, just for your service to the country, service to, as obviously, as a congressman, as a senator, as a soldier.
Yeah, he is what... I mean, we don't all agree with his politics all the time, but he is what made America great when it was. Really, he's the embodiment of a person who served this country, came back, served this country some more, stood up for his country, and stood up for what it means to be president, in contrast to what we have now.
All right, so what happens in Arizona with a seat?
Well, the governor gets to a point.
Well, we know that, Libby. Mm-hmm. We know the governor gets to a point. But the question is, who does he appoint? Because as Sarah just mentioned, this is not the same Republican Party as we used to have. This is now a Republican Party which eschews, you know, moderates. And so this governor has to decide whether or not he wants somebody like McCain, you know, who can reach across the aisle, who's a decent fellow, or whether he's going to take some conservative guy and or woman and appoint them to the seat. There is a feeling that maybe he'll appoint Mrs. McCain, which I would approve of. I would think that would be a very sharp move if she would take it. And that would give everybody some time. He says he won't appoint himself.
Well, the one thing, he also won't appoint until, you know, obviously...
After the services.
But what's interesting about this is that, you know, whoever Doug Ducey appoints will have 2+ years in office as a caretaker, and then that person would have to run for the remaining 2 years of his term in 2020. So, yes, I think to Alan's point, I mean, obviously he could choose a caretaker like Cindy McCain, or could choose somebody as a up-and-coming star of the Republican Party out in Arizona.
You know, Joe, sometimes those caretakers who are supposed to be caretakers decide to stay on, and we've seen it before.
The chair fits.
Yeah, right. And
it's comfy.
And, you know, and they stay on.
And think about what
we have to face here in terms of what might happen in this country in the next 2 years. This president may turn out to have either been thrown out, or indicted, or going to jail, and there may be a reaching back to more pleasant times.
Emily's list designated Arizona as a state to watch, and that's an interesting sign that there are some significant players in the Democratic Party who feel like they can turn that state, and I'm sure that that's probably weighing heavily on the mind of the governor as well.
This is a line in the New York Times article that says, with the Republicans clinging to a 50-49 Senate majority, 50-49, did I say that right? Majority. Hearings on the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh looming and Mr. Trump under intensifying legal scrutiny, Governor Ducey's choice carries enormous implications in Washington. What kind of pressure is on Governor Ducey right now?
Well, I have a feeling he won't be appointing this woman, Kelly Ward, who's running to fill Flake's seat, because she's a Republican, had the audacity to say publicly that they timed his announcement about no longer having treatment, which was the day before he died, to impact her campaign. It's like, how big is your ego?
Well, but as Sarah just said, the Emily's List is looking at Arizona as a place to maybe flip. On the other hand, the polls are showing this woman, and she's terrible. I agree with you. As running neck and neck in the primary.
In the Republican primary.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Obviously, we're going to, as Joe said, we have a series of remembrances that are going to be happening. The senator will be lying in state at the Capitol. There will be a service, I believe, on Saturday at the National Cathedral. Presidents Bush, George W., as well as Barack Obama will be eulogizing the senator, and then he will be buried in Annapolis.
Yeah, you know, politically, if we can return to that for 1 second, I think people are genuinely upset about the death of John McCain. I mean, I am, but on the other hand, this is a tremendous opportunity to bash this president by really coming on strong and announcing all his properties, which we know that this president doesn't have, reconciliation and everything else. And so you see a certain amount of it. Even the Schumer move to rename the building is brilliant.
It doesn't seem to matter, at least to his base. So it's also an opportunity, if we really want to change the discourse, for former presidents to sort of reclaim the presidency, to say this is what the presidency is all about. And we're going to show it by doing it. We're going to walk in the shoes that Trump has tried to fill and cannot. So there's another way, because I think that a lot of the Trump bashing is just falling on deaf ears and creating another silo that will tune us out to real critiques and things we should be paying attention to for November. So there's some clanging about that could be done, but I think some of the serious thinkers are also thinking about how do we model America as it should be as opposed to how it is right now.
Yeah, you know, Sarah, the independents in this are going to be crucial.
Yeah.
You know, you had Hillary getting the most votes by far. Mm-hmm. You had, you know, these three states which were turned by 70,000 votes. So but on the other hand, when they poll and they show him at 45% in popularity, that includes, a good number of independents who really are there. You know, Libby talked about make America, you know, white again. There is a lot of, there are an awful lot of white women, for example, who voted for this president and who I think may vote again that way. Because they accept that despicable sort of Emmett Till narrative. He didn't, but he whistled at a white woman, and we have to protect our white women in this
That's
country
right.
and the rest. It's really very scary.
But Libby keeps going back to the moms of America, mm-hmm. and I think you're right on that, especially after the other horrible thing that happened this weekend, the shooting in Jacksonville, Florida. Yeah. When you have moms demand action. And the young people who are mm-hmm. registering in record numbers.
This coalition, absolutely.
And don't forget that I think it was Georgia where they wanted to close down the polling places.
7 out of 9.
Right. They wanted to close down 7 out of 9 polling places in a predominantly black county. And it took 30 seconds for them to reverse the decision and not do it. So I think the people are starting to feel the heat and what goes on social media and the mainstream media. And I do think that I'm still hopeful because of all the organizing that's happening, the resistance. I mean, you don't see it out front in the news and in the Times or the nightly news every single day, but it is happening out in
Well,
communities.
You saw it in one congressional election.
Yes, you did.
And that's for sure where she was Cortez was losing by allegedly 35% and then won by 15, it's a total turnaround of
50%. But you also
50%.
Saw it in Conor Lamb's case.
Yeah.
And the razor-thin margin that the GOP guy in Ohio, he did Balderdash or Balderson or something like that.
Balderdash.
He did.
I don't think that was the
right.
name, but
yes,
go ahead.
Yes, yeah, but you know what I mean. Close it was enough. Balder yeah. something. But it was a razor-thin. They had to go down to absentees, and when it goes down to absentees, you know it's about a stronger field game on the other side.
Well, in Texas, Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz are within 4 points, I think.
It's 4 points.
Isn't
distance.
That unbelievable?
The margin of error. I think there's change
coming.
But
it is Texas.
Yeah. But statewide, it's not like it's just Austin.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, statewide.
If it only were.
Well, I worked on some of the field in the Obama election 2008 in Texas because I lived there for a couple of years. And you could feel it then. It was starting.
You feel the groundswell.
You do.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we would love to hear your thoughts. Libby Post is here, Joe Bonilla, Sarah Rogerson, and of course, Alan Chartok. And we will continue our topics this morning and include your letters, which again, you can simply address to us. Keep them short, to the point, and all of that. Panel@WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Joe Bonilla, and Libby Post. I'm Joe Donahue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan has a couple. We're working on a printer issue, which will be resolved momentarily, and then we'll have more letters. But in the moment, he's got two, and then we're going to move on to another topic, and then we'll come back.
And
to the
here
other
comes
stuff.
Some more.
Oh,
just,
they are. Look
just
at that.
As you
already.
Just said, Joe.
Yeah, see, look at that.
Nice.
Sarah
nice.
Is on
okay.
the move.
Oh, look, nice printing. Mark says, John McCain, I don't think Senator McCain would want us to bash President Trump on his behalf. It goes against everything he stood for. Let's ignore Trump this week and focus on the positive impact that Senator McCain had on America and the world. And that's from Mark and Latham. Good words, Mark. On the other hand, the now deceased Senator McCain made it clear he did not want that president at his funeral. Remember that?
Yeah. Although I agree with the
sentiment.
Let's focus on the senator and not the president. But as Libby said during the break, au contraire, I'm not sure he would really mind.
Let it go. I mean, look, he was thumbs down on the health care, and that was definitely one finger up to Trump, you know, and. Mm-hmm. And he's been made it very clear after Helsinki.
One finger up. Prep,
right. Mm-hmm. And you finally got that.
Yeah. There you go.
It's Monday. I'm trying.
And he took him to task after Helsinki. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Keep reading, honey.
Okay. Thank you. Matt says, panel, as a veteran, I decided early on in the 2016 campaign that I could not support a narcissistic draft-dodging Trump after his derogatory comments about McCain's war service. Trump's recent comments comparing Mueller, a decorated Marine war hero, to McCarthy is a new low even for him. The man has no dignity, does not belong in the White House. Why any veteran would support Trump is simply incomprehensible. And that's from Matt.
Especially considering who he's put in charge of the Veterans Affairs. It's a bunch of his personal favors. And, I mean, it's very clear where he stands on veterans issues.
Mm-hmm. And Mary says, why no National Day of Mourning? Is it because one petty man that a National Day of Mourning has not been declared? It is up to the states to individually honor Senator McCain by lowering flags. Is it up to the states? It's a question. To individually honor Senator McCain by lowering flags? Good point, Mary. Okay. And then Bob says, great. Trump's slogan of Make America Great Again rings extra hollow upon reflection of John McCain's service to America. If anyone exemplifies the greatness of America, it was Senator McCain and the reaction of Trump and his, quote, basket of deplorables. And yes, that's what they are, in parenthesis. It's double clear how low the Trump wing has sunk, and that's from Bob English. And yet, folks, a whole bunch of new polls are coming out and showing him, with all of the McCain stuff and everything else, a point or two up. So that the Trump base, which basically are Republicans who see the division of America, in my opinion, between the haves and the have-nots, and want the haves to keep everything they have, and Trump is giving them that.
Well, I think those polls may have been conducted after the death of Molly Tibbetts as well.
Right.
And before this.
Yeah. So yeah. I think those are more reflective of the anti-immigrant sentiment that he has very carefully and surgically and in a calculated way sowed all over the United States.
So, Sarah, how do you – you're the expert. You're our expert on immigration. How do you answer people who say that to you? You know, here's a good example of an immigrant – who came over illegally and killed a young woman. And I want to know what the best way to answer that is.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again, and I can't believe I talk about this organization as much as I do, given my political leanings at this point. But the Cato Institute, immediately after the news hit, and by the way, that individual was also employed by a farm, which I believe was at least partially owned by a Republican congressperson. So there's a lot more to the story. That person had also been e-verified, which means they had been through the process of being verified as a lawful employee. I would say look beneath the headlines. The Cato Institute said that punishing immigrants for the bad act of one person is the worst way to go about crafting policy on immigration in the United States, and that actually crime rates fall where the numbers of immigrants have gone up. So it's just a way to gin up controversy and hate against one particular group of individuals when really, you know, more people died this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. At least I'm not sure that they've revealed the identity of the attacker.
Oh, you mean in Gainesville or
Jacksonville?
Yeah. He was a kid from Baltimore.
And most of the mass shooting...
His last name was Katz.
Oh, boy. Most of the perpetrators are white men.
Mm-hmm.
United States citizen.
That's right.
White men. So if you want to talk about crime prevention in this country, we should be redirecting our gaze.
That's right.
Albert says, enough with war heroes. Honor the man for service to the country, but please don't whitewash America's criminal war. In Southeast Asia, AJ, a veteran who's not so proud of his service. That's what he says. Okay, and Susan says, McCain dossier. Wonder if Trump also holds a grudge against McCain because McCain flew overseas to get the Steele dossier and put it into the hands of the FBI and Comey. Anybody familiar with this?
I don't know that story.
No.
Neither.
No, I never heard that.
Mm-mm. Yeah, maybe it's the Russians writing this.
Okay,
and then, no, it isn't. Okay, and Brucey says, doesn't budge up or down. Trump started with 47% approval, has fallen to 41%, is locked in that narrow range. I saw a stat this morning that Republicans have lost 15 million people willing to self-identify as Republicans in Trump's term. Trump's disrespect for McCain will only accelerate that. Yes, but there are those three states, there were those 70,000 votes, and I want to know how much of that has changed, because otherwise you're going to get them again.
All right, let's let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and move on to other stuff. I would like to get to the shooting in Florida, as well as talk about the Pope under fire from a cardinal, which is an interesting story as well. We'll get to all of that. We'll include your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll do that right after this short break. Two letters and then we'll move on to other stuff.
Okay,
Joe. Welcome back.
Okay, Joe. Robert says, McCain's empty seat. How interesting it would be to have Senator Jeff Flake serve out Senator John McCain's term. We can use having another plain-spoken senator. Of course, Flake is one of those guys who's leaving.
Yeah.
And now, when he leaves, he has the guts to say what ought to be said when you're an incumbent.
Well, he's leaving to run for president.
Yeah, good luck.
Undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. Right.
Ramon, who writes to us quite frequently, says, McCain, in a political way, is a personal loss. I'm going to sound selfish, as this should be a time to focus on the consideration of McCain's family and loved ones. But he has been my write-in for president since Clinton's first term. Was glad that I got to vote for him when he was a candidate and continued after. Now I find myself without anyone to vote for, possibly indefinitely, if only D.C. had more like him. And that's from Ramon.
All right. This story is breaking and has just come over, so we can talk about it real quick. That is, if I can bring it up very quickly on the it was coming up on, there we go. The U.S. and Mexico agreed to a preliminary NAFTA deal. This story just breaking. The United States and Mexico have reached agreement to revise key portions of the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, and a preliminary deal could be announced today, a crucial step towards revamping a trade pact that has appeared on the brink of collapse during the past year of negotiations. Reaching an agreement on how to revise some of the most contentious portions of what President Trump has long called the worst trade pact in history would give Mr. Trump a significant win in a trade war he has started with countries around the globe, including Mexico, Canada, the European Union, and China. Still, a preliminary agreement between the U.S. and Mexico would fall far short of actually revising NAFTA. The preliminary agreement still excludes Canada, which is also a party to NAFTA, but has been absent from talks held in Washington in recent weeks. It centers on the rules governing the automobile industry and leaves aside other contentious issues that affect all three countries. The revised NAFTA would also need congressional approval before it can go into effect, including votes by Republican lawmakers who have been loud in their criticisms about some of the president's plans for remaking the deal.
Well, you know, put yourself in the position of the president of Mexico, and what you have to do in order to keep the sort of baseline economy that you have. Do you have to give in? And of course, Trump needs a win desperately right now, and may make the deal a little bit more palatable than he would under ordinary circumstances, because he needs that win.
Well, I mean, the one big takeaway from this is obviously this all centers around automobile manufacturing. I know Ford and General Motors have plants in Mexico. Fiat Chrysler is more for Canada. But, you know, certainly as we look to, you know, the shifting in automobile manufacturing from really sedans and cars to SUVs, I mean, this has a huge impact in terms of our economic future.
How so, Joe? I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, the cost of these vehicles, and obviously right now there has been a lot of consumer confidence in terms of SUVs recently. The issue is that as fuel prices remain steady and relatively low, you know, people are looking to get more SUVs, and therefore production would continue to increase.
You think $3 a gallon is low?
Relatively low when you think about it. But when it gets to 5-6, we'll start seeing consumer trends change again.
Okay. Okay.
I wonder if there's a wall in the new NAFTA treaty.
Oh, yeah, wall.
Yeah.
An actual wall?
Yeah, if there's going to be a wall, it's part of it.
All right. Anybody else have anything on that? Okay.
No.
Let's go to the story of the event in Jacksonville where two people passed as a result of a shooting at a video game day. I want to say convention, but it was an event at a video game event playing Madden 2019. Three people, including the alleged shooter who took his own life, died at a video game tournament live stream from Jacksonville, Florida. 11 people were injured. Investigators seeking answers today about the gunman, they say, opened fire during the tournament. He turned the gun on himself. David Katz, 24 years old from Baltimore. Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams said Katz was attending the competition, which drew professional players from around the world, but added that he did not know what could have motivated the shooting or if the attacker knew the victims. The shooting rampage turned a Madden NFL 19 competition at the Jacksonville Landing, a popular riverfront gathering place in the city's core, into the latest public gathering suddenly shattered by gun violence. The violence also added Jacksonville, Florida's biggest city by population and size, to the grim roster of places thrust into the national consciousness following a burst of gunfire. A list that in the Sunshine State alone has recently included Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, and, of course, Parkland.
I just learned something. I had no idea that Jacksonville was the largest city in Florida.
Nor did I.
Yes.
One would take an educated guess at Miami, but apparently not.
Miami's number three. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, nonetheless, I mean, having, yeah, I consider almost South Florida like almost a second home in a way, and having Parkland and obviously what happened at the Fort Lauderdale Airport, and then I was actually in Florida when Pulse happened in Orlando. It's the unfortunate thing where, you know, there's a lot of talk right now, but we need actual substantial action in terms of real gun control. When will it be finally enough? And that's the question, but especially for Florida as well.
So what is your sense of the psyche of America, and particularly in Florida, which you know well, that somebody now gets this message, our kids are dying, adults are dying, I'm at risk, and I refuse to go along with anything to control guns. What do you think the message in that person's head is it that I need my gun in order to protect myself still?
Yeah. It,
definitely in Florida. And, you know, especially when you head up to northern Florida, that, up toward the panhandle, that's especially true.
Pork chop country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it goes back again to the fear-based narrative, and that really plays well for all of these issues. If you make people afraid enough that they would actually put their own child's life on the line over a policy disagreement, that's a pretty powerful statement. The NRA spends lots and lots of money to be able to continue to feed people that information.
But are they compartmentalizing, Sarah? Do they actually think that they're putting, you say, that they're willing to put their child's life on the line? Do they really think they're putting their child's life on the line?
I don't know what they think.
The ones who want the guns, they think they're protecting their children by having guns.
Well, that's
and the NRA, in the original article we read this morning, the NRA had a statement, that woman who speaks out for them, saying we need more guns. You know, if everybody had more guns, this would have been more secure. No, all what would have happened is more people would have gotten shot and killed in this place.
And of course, on top of all of this comes the new round of let's arm the teachers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
From Betsy DeVos.
Right. Right. Somebody's making a lot of money.
It is the video that came out, it was you could hear the sounds. The video was of the actual gaming tournament with the live feed of those playing. So you saw you didn't see anything other than the game that was being played. But what you heard were the gunshots and the what was happening in the room. And it's just, you know, I'm glad we're not becoming numb to it, but it's still just horrifying to hear it. And yet it doesn't really seem to make, because it just seems so, it's just like, we're playing, everything's fine, and then everything's horrible. And it's so gut-wrenching to hear that and the people's reaction to it. And I hope we don't become numb to that.
No.
Well, this is all still post-effects of the NRA's lobbyist there, Marion Hammer, who has been pretty much the patron of so many Florida Republicans for decades. Had this had happened in, let's say, here in New York State, I think we would actually see some action to that. But it's truly unfortunate that in Florida that there will never be, unfortunately, any change in the near future, unless, some Republicans actually grow a backbone.
It reminded me of hearing, we've heard it in Las Vegas, we've heard it in Orlando, we have so much audio of the horror. I think we need to find space in the conversation, and I think the kids from Park, I keep calling them kids, the young people from Parkland had a summer tour, walking across the country and having real conversations with gun owners about what would make sense. And there's, in a lot of the polls, there are gun owners who say that they are all for responsible gun ownership and responsible regulation of other folks' gun ownership. And I know lots of gun owners in mm-hmm. upstate New York who feel the same way. It's just that there hasn't been, the space hasn't been made in the national conversation for that. It's just more of the, either you're for gun control or you're against it. Right. Either you're a Republican or you're a Democrat.
Either you're pro-choice or pro-death. It's like the same kind of stuff. It's either one or the other. There's no shades of gray, and people don't want, and if you give people shades of gray, that means they actually have to think, and that's something that people don't want to do. They don't want to have to analyze. They don't want to have to think about this stuff. They just want to say, I want my guns, and that's it.
But I keep thinking about, people getting angry, and what would happen if they didn't have a gun at the moment that they were getting angry. Mm-hmm. I confess that one of the things I look back on and I'm most ashamed of in my life is that my partner in a bridge game when I was about 13 bid clubs when he should have been hearts, and I jumped across the table. I was quite angry with him, So no, I'm kidding about that, of course. But I'm not kidding about that.
No, it's true. But it's true. People immediately vent their anger with weapons now,
or even against themselves. The woman who recently underwent a face transplant. That was a story where she had access to a firearm. She was very upset, and she attempted suicide. And it was literally minutes, where she could have so-called cooled off, in order for that not to have been the outcome. And so she hasn't emerged as an outspoken advocate for gun reform. But that's part of what's going on here is that they've also been used. The leading cause of death for accidental child deaths, they're one of the top five, is guns.
Yeah.
And we don't address. And I always say this after every one of these events.
Happy Monday morning.
But it's every single it just seems that we of course we have to talk about guns and we have to talk about reforms and we have to talk about all of that, but we also have to get to the root of the problem as to in this case, as you mentioned this earlier, Sarah, so many of these from 18 to 22, 24 years old males. So what's happening there? And let's talk about that anger, and let's talk about the mental health of those people who see no other option than are willing to kill themselves in the process.
And the inculcation of our values. I keep thinking a program I sort of enjoy is The Rifleman with Chuck Connors. It's this guy with his gun. Yeah. And then they come around and when they're advertising it, they say, not only is it one of the most popular programs in history in the United States, but around the world, they proudly say, look at what we're exporting.
It's still on. You can watch it. It's like you can watch Law & Order. You can watch it anytime.
Yeah, which is good.
That's good. At least we know the rifle.
Right.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be back right after this short break. All right. Final act of the roundtable panel for this morning. We welcome your letter. Yeah, just for today, not for in general. Yeah, no, I didn't know. We're not bowing out yet. We got a show tomorrow. All right. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan has a few of those, and then we'll move on to some other stuff.
Well, thank you, Joe. I do agree with Alan and Libby. This one begins, Politicizing John McCain's Death is the title. In most circumstances, I would be disappointed at the politicizing of the death of an American hero and statesman. However, McCain himself politicized his own death by stating through family statements his request that President Trump not attend his services. Honor his life by using his death to help defeat this nightmare of failed leadership, and that's from Jim in Montgomery. And Sarah says, Dossier McCain. We were all sort of surprised by that when we heard it. In the restless wave, Senator McCain discussed at length how he came to acquire the dossier and turn it over to the FBI. When I read the book, I thought I was the only one who had missed that information, but I guess not. And that's from Sarah. Okay. And then J.D.R. says, polite, responsible persons do not need to point out foibles of frail persons. That will all become evident as time passes. Hold on, steady hand to the tiller, maintain decorum and decency. And that's J.D., who is listening in Springfield, Massachusetts, and has for quite a while now. And Frank says, two ings about Trump. I noticed that the American flag on the White House today was not at half-staff. The half-staff status is supposed to be in place until after the funeral of the person who died. All other flags are still at half staff. Is this a final dig at McCain? Even in death, this low-life president can't stop being a disrespectful jerk. Also, Trump also hates McCain because he was a strong, outspoken, anti-Putin politician, and Trump loves Putin, so this was another reason to hate McCain. You know, it's interesting because the word is out this morning that the people in the administration are going to have greater sanctions against Russia. So here's another thing. Here is Trump in the hands of Putin for God knows what reason, and yet the people in the lower, you know, the cabinet posts are allowed to enforce and to put sanctions in place. It's an interesting strategy.
Anybody? No? Okay.
Yeah.
I wonder
there's a lot of
who
hands in the air. Nobody's actually speaking, right. Which doesn't work on the radio,
you know,
but okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I just wonder who these sanctions are really against. You know, are they cherry-picking people who really aren't that important to Putin? Who knows? You know, they just make these statements, oh, we're going to put sanctions, and then we don't hear anything more about it.
Well, except that we do hear from time to time how bad
the economy in
Russia is and how he needs those sanctions removed and that he's quite angry about it and that is what he's been trying to negotiate in these meetings with Trump.
All right, let's move on to other topics and see what else we can discuss this morning. There is the story about the Pope, I wonder why. Did the New York Times pull that story?
No.
It's there.
Because, well, it's on
the... Well, anyway, the point is...
Well, hold on. I got it.
I know the point.
All right, go ahead. You can say the point.
No, that's okay.
No, go ahead.
You're the chief of the program. Whatever you say goes.
The Pope declines to the former Vatican ambassador said that Pope Francis and Pope Benedict knew of sexual misconduct allegations against McCarrick for years. This is a former Vatican ambassador to the United States has alleged in an 11-page letter that Pope Benedict and Pope Francis, among other top Catholic Church officials, had been aware of sexual misconduct allegations against former D.C. Archbishop Cardinal Theodore McCarrick years before he resigned this summer. The letter from Archbishop Carlo Vigano, who was recalled from his D.C. post in 2016 amid allegations that he'd become embroiled in the conservative American fight against same-sex marriage, was first reported by the National Catholic Register and LifeSite News, two conservative Catholic sites. The accusation sent a shockwave across the reeling Roman Catholic Church, but the letter offered no proof of its claims, and Pagano on Sunday told the Washington Post that he wouldn't comment further beyond confirming that he was the letter's author. Meanwhile, the Pope has said this came as the Pope was wrapping up one of his most challenged trips of his papacy, where in Ireland he came face to face with the national anger and grief caused by decades of abuse. Francis said, "We ask for forgiveness for some members of the church's hierarchy who did not take charge of these painful situations and kept quiet." And the Cardinal, Vagano is calling for the Pope to resign in this 11-page letter, which is also key as well.
Now, you had Benedict, of course, resigning, stepping aside, retiring, whatever you want to call it. And in light of all of this, it does seem that it's possible that that was because he saw the train coming down the track. And, you know, who knows, but it is certainly possible. Look, I frankly look at this, and I don't know how the church extricates itself. I just don't know. Because along the line, everybody in power had to know. They had to know. You couldn't even think that it was possible that Pope Francis, who I have great respect for, didn't know about this, because he had to. And his first reaction, right? Am I wrong about this? But his first reaction was sort of defensive. And then when he got hit real hard as a result of that, he seems to have come out a lot more forcefully. But I just don't know how you extricate yourself from this.
You know, if Ireland is turning against the church, then you know you have a really big problem on your
hands.
Well,
that's been happening for a while.
But it's because of this. I mean, you know, you have the, for the lack of a better word, the downgrading of organized religion across the globe. And you've got the rise of these non-denominational Christian churches, the mega churches, where they have their own fair share of abuse, and that's come to light in America plenty of times. But you no longer have this lockstep support of the church like you did when I was a kid. Or, you know, I know, Alan, when you were younger, you know, what we grew up with, to see how people responded and how much they respected the church. So I too don't know if they're going to be able to really weather this storm. But I'm not Catholic,
as the one Catholic, least here.
Two of us.
That's right.
The two Joes.
One thing I would say is that, you know, if you look at like papal politics, if you will, you know, given that, you know, Pope Francis come from Argentina, and went with South America being really the largest contingent of Catholics in the world. I don't see this being really a route that would lead to Francis's, you know, resignation. I really don't see that at this juncture. Now, certainly that's certainly in the cards, maybe down the road. But you have to realize it's only been two papal resignations in the last 600 years: Gregory the 12th in 1415, and then Benedict a few years ago. So I do think that we have a real problem in the church, and it could come down to maybe convening something similar to what we did in the early 60s with Vatican II, maybe doing a Vatican III.
And if you did a Vatican III, Joe, being Catholic and having spoken up, what would you do at Vatican III? What is it that you would put on the table and say, here's the reform? Because the big issue has been, you know, not we're going to pray, not we're going to think, but you have to do something. And what is the doing?
Well, I think it's going to be a long, hard look in terms of the church's practices, not just from the last 60 years since Vatican II, but obviously looking at how can the church really step into the modern age, but also coming to light, obviously, the challenges and the unfortunate abuses of the past.
So are you hinting, for example, allowing male clerics to marry?
I think anything's on the table, I think, but certainly that's something that needs to be discussed.
Women priests.
Right.
Yeah, marriage. I mean, these are all mm-hmm. issues that this pope has, for the most part, said no to over the years of his papacy. The one thing I would take, and I realize this is, just linguistics, but I don't know, Libby, if there's so much turning against the church as questioning the church. I think there's an internal strife within the church between, as in politics, a conservative and liberal mm-hmm. factions, and I also think that people that still have the faith but want changes so they can have that faith without questioning it and believing what they're being told. It is hard. It's really hard to know that if this is true. And I just wanted to put this into the conversation that the Pope did not deny the allegations, but sidestepped the questions by insisting he would not dignify them with a response. I'll not say a single word about this. I believe the statement speaks for itself, and you have the sufficient journalistic ability to make your conclusions. Mm-hmm. And it's an act of trust, which seems like an unfortunate choice of words given what we're talking about here, and at the center of this, of what Vigano was saying as Archbishop, is that he had personally informed Francis in 2013 of Cardinal McCarrick's history of abuse. That's a hard one to get around if you did know about it and then nothing is
well nothing it's is just done. Like American politics, where it's always the cover-up. It's always when did you know, and how did you know, and what did you know, and all the rest of it, and there's very little way out of that one.
Although you can't deny the political element to this, and that that these allegations are being brought forward by political enemies of,
right.
of the Pope,
because exactly.
this is papal politics.
But you know what, Sarah, you're an outstanding professor, and you know this.
Why, thank you.
Yeah, no, you are. We know that. But this whole idea of motive stops being all that important if the factual pattern is correct. So, for example, if somebody says, if a wife or a husband who's divorcing brings something to the table and says she or he did something, we all tell our students, what's the difference if the information is right?
Well, I think it's a symptom of a larger political problem. And I guess, as a good Lutheran should, I say, look to the Lutherans who have navigated this. There are places in the Lutheran Church that are very accepting and have open policies towards same-sex marriage, all the way back to the other side of the pendulum that is still struggling with those issues. You have people leaving the church over it, mm-hmm. finding different congregations to go to, and now it's sort of like this spectrum of where people end up feeling comfortable. Women are ordained in the Lutheran Church. I am the product of Lutherans being able to marry. My father's a Lutheran minister. And when we were growing up, he always said, let politicians take care of people's purse strings and let us take care of their souls. And so he was always very firm that politics didn't have a place in the church, that the church was supposed to be a place where people of all political backgrounds could gather and experience their spirituality and their commonality, not their differences. And what's happening with not just the Catholic Church, but churches across this country, is that the politics is no longer held outside the church door. And in some ways, that can be done responsibly. In other ways, it's not. And it's creating additional division among people that used to worship together, which is, when you think about it, just one of the most sacred human experiences. So it's a shame what's happening. If they want to find a way forward, it's to return to their faith, not to continue to play whatever the partisan equivalent is in the Catholic Church.
It bothers me as a Catholic. It bothers me that we're at a place where it's deemed extraordinary that the Pope is making an admission that there was abuse. While in Ireland, but that admission should have been made 17, 20 years ago.
Right.
Which has been going on for decades prior to that.
It is interesting, however, that there is a real spirit of anti-clericalism, both in Ireland and certainly in Italy, where all kinds of reforms have been, passed against the dire predictions of doom and gloom by the church. It happens, and you know, I don't want to start something here, but in terms of history, you know, it is very difficult for a religion that is founded, for example, by Luther. You want to go read anti-Semitism, which is worse than Hitler's. You know, you read what Luther said. And yet, the wonderful people in the Lutheran Church have been able to navigate a way around that and to say, okay, that was then, this is now, and these are our principles.
Right. It's the modernization of faith that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Across the board.
Right. Across the board. Our constitution changes and we have systems set up for that. There's just not a good system. It's more fragmented because it's religion by religion, faith by faith. And I think that's why a lot of people are turned off by so-called organized religion, because that's what it is. It's just another bureaucracy.
And it is a bureaucracy. On all levels, it's a bureaucracy. But we can't forget that we're talking about real victims of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and that I've read stories where they blame the kids. Seven-year-old boys have the ability to make their own decisions. You know, it's like the excuses of pedophiles long held. You know, they knew what they were doing, and they're 7 years old. They did not know. They did not consent. And give me a break. And even Bill Donahue, who is from the New York State, the Catholic, I can't remember exactly what the name of his organization, but he really defends the church beyond all defense, and he too went down that road. And that, to me, shows the bankruptcy and the moral bankruptcy of some of these folks who will use whatever they need to use in order to abuse other people.
There's also the issue of we can talk about fundamental changes in the church, but they also have to do, they have to do a lot more for the victims. That's and immediately.
It's the church's responsibility.
Absolutely.
It is not the state's responsibility, because in New York State, the Senate Republicans wanted to put forth a compromise that there would be a taxpayer-funded pool to compensate people, and that is a waste of taxpayer money. That's not who should be paying for this. The church has the money to pay for it. If it bankrupts the church, so be it, because they are responsible for what happened.
But, Libby, don't you think it's not only what we should be doing for the victims, which is certainly right, you're exactly right on that, but also what we have to do moving forward? Because there have to be rules in place that, for example, it goes without saying, and I think everybody's arrived at this now, you know, you see a predator and you turn him over to the district attorney, not to the, clerical authorities.
Separation of church and state does not mean that church or any religious organization gets to commit a crime.
Yeah. And by the way, it doesn't stop at the Catholic Church. We've had stories about predators who were Jewish. We've had stories about, people who were, in social organizations. You know, this is endemic.
We have about a minute left, and the last thing I have on my list is the fact that we lost another big loss over the weekend was the death of Neil Simon, the master of Broadway and of comedy. He wrote for Sid Caesar, for goodness sakes. He wrote for Phil Silvers. He was one of the most popular playwrights of our time. He ruled Broadway with The Odd Couple and Plaza Suite and Sunshine Boys, and of course his autobiographical work of Brighton Beach Memoirs and Biloxi Blues and Broadway Bound. And so he died at 91 yesterday. Mm-hmm. And
good run.
A good run.
Well, may his memory be a blessing for all of us. He wrote some of the stuff that defined generations and defined what it was to be on Broadway. I grew up with Neil Simon as a constant, from The Odd Couple on TV. I know he didn't write it, but he wrote the play, to everything else that he's done.
I still, every time one of these individuals passes, I just think of just what an incredible thing this was. But in Sid Caesar's show of shows, it was Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon,
Carl Reiner,
Woody Allen, and Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
And many of them spent their summers on Fire Island.
I'm sure they did. Hocking with you, right?
And on that, right. we'll close out. We'll let that be the final word. Don't forget the Berkshire Ramblers this Sunday, 7 o'clock at the Guthrie Center, and we'll be back after this short break.
Bless you, Justin.